I'm Alex.
And I'm Matt, and welcome back to the show. Our guest this week is Matthew Castle, an independent multimedia journalist and filmmaker based in Istanbul. A writer, photographer, and videographer, he's reported from the Middle East, North Africa, Europe, and beyond. His most recent work was a six-part documentary film about Syrian refugees making the trek to Europe, which was featured in The New Yorker.
So what have you been up to recently, Matt?
Quite a bit. I've been all over the place, really. I guess the most interesting thing would be I was fortunate enough to partake in a track to dialogue, track to diplomacy conference in Moscow, and that was the Dartmouth conference hosted by Dartmouth College and the Kettering Foundation. It's a long-standing conference which goes back to the 1960s, where essentially prominent Americans go meet prominent Russians and hash out. Yeah, exactly. We solve all problems. We at least diagnose them. I think that's a good step, accurately. But yeah, this was a week in Moscow, chatting with a lot of folks who were a lot of Russia experts and kind of analysts from the American side. I was brought in as a Middle East guy and also a young guy to try and get some blood and young blood in there, which I'm good at being young, that I can do. I don't know about the rest of it. And it was interesting. I spent a week at a kind of a Russian foreign ministry compound, all off the record discussions about like the Russian view towards Iran, Syria, Europe, Ukraine, perceptions of America, and most interestingly, trying to explain in like very objective and unbiased tones the state of the American electoral system and American elections. So I was very interested, and they were very interested in our takes on like perceptions of Russia and what they're up to in the world. And of course, a lot of that focused around Syria and Ukraine. So
I've kind of been watching your Goodreads queue as it accumulates more and more books about Russia.
Yeah, exactly. Must read everything, which I believe you've also said on a handful of occasions. And for now, I'm back in Turkey with our usual work with Syrian refugees and aid analysis. What have you been up to, Alex? From tracking you along, I see you're up to all kinds of things. And what's this new language thing you're launching?
Yeah, I started, I've kind of been doing it informally with a bunch of people, you know, discussing over the years, as they were learning languages, ways that they could improve it. You and I, in fact, like first met over the glint of an Anki deck or not an Anki deck. So I just kind of decided now that I'm kind of slowly winding up my PhD and my obligations with regards to that, more on that in a future episode, I hope. I wanted to formalize this and do this on a more kind of regular level or kind of just let people know that this is something that I do.
So what's we talk all the time about kind of learning in particular, language learning specifically, you know, what are you offering in this that's, you know, very interesting or novel? What's the take?
Yeah, I mean, kind of my experience, at least over the last, last 3, 4, 5 years, talking to people about their problems and their struggles learning languages, not to mention my own struggles for many years kind of learning languages, has been that, or at least the kind of the insight which surprised me was that a lot of the major problems or obstacles that people have in learning languages have nothing to do with the language itself and the specific difficulties of Arabic, let's say, or Japanese or whatever. Most of the problems are kind of meta problems relating to motivation, coming up with plans, setting appropriate goals, having some kind of accountability, all of those kinds of things, which I'm sure as anyone if anyone has tried to learn a language, like all of these things will be familiar to you. So what I do with people is essentially work on those problems. It's not like I'm teaching Arabic or Pashto or any of the languages that I speak. I work with people to come up with usually a kind of 3-month plan and then check in with them once a week, and we talk about the things that did work over the past week and the things which didn't work, and we talk about possible ways to make, you know, just to keep language learning interesting, to ways to be more efficient. At the beginning, a lot of it is just kind of introducing people to Anki and just basic skills and techniques, but then later on it becomes more kind of working with people to figure out what works best for them. And there's no one way, obviously, for any one person. Everyone is kind of unique. It's just kind of, it really helps, at least I found the people who I've worked with, it really helps for them to just talk through some of these problems with them. And it almost seems like something that one wouldn't need to do, but just given how many people study a language for 1, 2, 3 weeks, maybe as much as 2 months, and then give up because they lose the motivation, right? Or they lose, it you need something else unless you're just kind of a super motivated person. That's kind of what I offer.
Yeah, sounds quite useful actually, to just getting things done in general. Beyond even the language, it's kind of like an approach, sounds like.
And in fact, I'm at some point in the near future going to be starting up an Arabic language podcast.
Awesome.
One of the things that I'll do, I'll be with an Egyptian co-host who I have been studying with for a while. One of the things we will do is kind of language clinics. If you come and bring us your Arabic language related problems, ideally we kind of want to pitch the podcast to people who have been studying for a while, i.e. not complete beginners. We'll talk about some of these problems in Arabic if you can, in English if not. Just as a way of kind of reaching other people, in particular trying to provide some kind of material for people who are kind of a medium level, who've studied for a few years, because there are a lot of great materials now for complete beginners, and there's tons of material for people who are really good and who've been studying for 10, 20 years, but it's hard to find materials in the middle. So we're hoping to kind of target that group of people in the middle.
Excellent. No, it's great stuff. And I know many Middle East studies folks probably find that very, very useful. I thought this was a good show. Very interesting. His getting into the mechanics and the kind of nuts and bolts of, how do you put together a documentary film? How do you put together, what are the kind of thematic things that you need to work through, and how do you actually follow somebody on a journey, from Syria all the way into deep into Europe? What are the complications that come into that? And as always on this show, what are the roles of languages and spending a long time in the region? What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about that stuff quite a lot, about the importance of being able to experience and do research, experience stories and talk to people in their own language and so on. I kind of don't think you can say it enough, particularly since so few people, journalists or researchers or whatever, take the time. That was the thing which kind of stood out for me most, even though he's very much kind of preaching to the choir to me on that. If we convince one or two people as a result of this episode to take the plunge and to make the effort, then it's certainly worth it.
Yep, absolutely. And without further ado, here's the show.
So I'm from Chicago. It's a really long story. I'll try to give you the short version. But basically, I was, and maybe you guys are as well, from the kind of like 9/11 generation. I was 19 when the Twin Towers were struck, and then, my country went to war. And then soon after was talking about another war in Iraq. So I was very kind of interested, firstly, in the reasons why someone would want to attack America in the way they did on 9/11. And then I was trying to whoa, why are we rushing to two wars halfway across the world? Let's try to get an understanding of what's going on. And I became an anti-war activist without really knowing much about the Middle East or the region here, but, you know, more because I felt like these wars were forced on the American people, and me, my peers, people I grew up with, we really didn't understand, you know, what was happening. But, you know, there was widespread support for, especially in the wake of 9/11, for what the American government was doing in Afghanistan and Iraq. So I kind of wanted, first I became an anti-war activist, and then I wanted to understand what was happening here. So I made my first trip to Israel and Palestine, and that was in 2003. I wanted to go to Iraq initially, but, you know, after March 20th, when the invasion began, it was pretty dangerous, especially for someone who had never been to the region before.
So you traveled, and, you traveled before the invasion or after?
After the invasion. I went in like the summer of 2003. I went to the West Bank and to Israel, and I went on a delegation of kind of like Palestinian and non-Palestinian fact finders to try to see what's going on there. And yeah, once I saw what was happening in the West Bank under Israeli occupation in Palestinian communities, it kind of, my whole world changed because I had no idea. And, you know, I've also made a 2-hour film about this for Al Jazeera, but my mom's Jewish and I was raised Jewish and had the kind of narrative of Israel as being a savior, a safe haven for Jews after the horrors of the Holocaust. And then to see that symbol that had come to represent, you know, oppressed people in World War II, the Star of David, seeing it not worn on the patches of jackets of Jewish people like it was in the concentration camps and so on, but to see it waving over this checkpoint where Palestinians from the young to the very old are being oppressed and forced to wait for hours on end under the baking sun. And I'm not equating the Holocaust with the occupation at all, but just to see that kind of like symbol being used in such a different way really struck me and really changed my view on a lot of things. And since that point in 2003, when I was 20, 21 years old, I've been mostly in the Middle East for almost 12, 13 years. Now I'm in Athens. But the whole kind of everything I've been trying to do is just trying to better understand what's happening in the region, better understand the people who've been affected by all these conflicts. And I think that really kind of like sums up my work.
Did you come from a kind of journalism background or writing in some way, or like did your education have anything to do with that, or is that something new?
I came from a no, I didn't come from a journalism background. I came from a I studied photography, but that was, again, I switched to studying photography once, you know, I started to care about things after 9/11. And but I had no intention of ever wanting to be a journalist, especially not a filmmaker. I was just a normal kid from Chicago, and kind of got, yeah, just naturally kind of happened. And once I went to the Middle East and I started writing emails to friends, I realized in a way I was committing an act of journalism, let's say. You know, I was reporting on what was happening. Yeah, and slowly the kind of transition from human rights observer, human rights activist, kind of led me to becoming a journalist.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, one of your more, or probably your most recent work is a series of videos that have appeared, I think, most widely in The New Yorker. And these are, you know, the work entitled The Journey from Syria. And this is where you tell the story and stories of folks moving essentially from the Middle East and heading to Europe. We'd like to get into that a little bit. You know, what's the background on those? What made you decide to you know, put this together as an important issue? Obviously, the entire world was very, you know, is to some extent and definitely was fixated on the plight of these folks coming out of southern Turkey, moving through Istanbul and elsewhere. You know, where did this idea come from for you, and what was the importance of telling this story?
Well, as you know, being based in Turkey, the refugee issue is nothing new, and especially in the Middle East, there are refugees before Syrians. It's a big, but especially with the Syrian, the ongoing war in Syria, there's millions of refugees based in the Middle East. And when I was based in Turkey last year, and I was close to a lot of the Syrians who were there, and I could just tell that something early on in 2015, I could tell that there was like this this anxiety that like people have been there. People like Aboud, who's the person I follow for the majority of the film, you know, they were fed up because he had come to Aboud. I'm talking speaking about his case. He had come to Turkey in search of work so that he could bring his family from Syria, his wife and two kids. He never had any desire to go to Europe. But after 2.5 years of trying to work in odd jobs in Istanbul, he realized he couldn't make a living for himself, let alone, you know, a family of four. So that's when he kind of made the decision that he had to get asylum in Europe and then apply for family reunification, which is granted to asylum seekers under EU law. So he had tried all of these times, and I met him through a friend because I'm close with a lot of the Syrians. Most of them, 95% of them have now gone to Europe in the past year or so. But I was close to a lot of Syrians back then. And Aboud and a friend of ours had actually approached me because they wanted UN contacts in Greece and thought because I was a journalist, I could help them with that because he was trying to go to Greece by land, not on the dinghies, the rubber dinghies that became popular later in the year. Anyway, and he was trying all of these difficult trips. He had tried twice to Bulgaria. This was going to be his, when I met him, he was trying his fourth attempt to Europe. This was to Greece. And I was just like so amazed by this father's kind of like, how motivated this father was to take this humiliating, difficult, dangerous trip to Europe by land. And he had already failed three times and he was trying for the fourth time just so he could be with his wife and his two kids. So I had no intention. I had no intention of making a film at that point. And I was working. I don't need to mention names, but I was working regularly for an outlet at that point. And I was really trying to pitch a number of stories related to Syrian refugees in Turkey. And there was very little interest in March, April, May, even up till June. There was very little interest among editors. I just said, screw it. And I was so amazed by this guy that I just started filming him. We had no idea. He had no idea what was going to happen, if he was going to make it to Greece. I had obviously no idea either. And one thing led to another, and he just made it one step further on the trip. And I just kept following him until he eventually arrived to the Netherlands in late June of 2015.
I mean, I watched this a few weeks ago, this was, in fact, what kind of provoked me to get in touch with you. And I think two things kind of stood out for me as interesting from the film, or kind of unique perspectives. Both the fact that you weren't just following along, as it wasn't just the story of yourself and this journey, but there was also this kind of dual narrative of what was going on in Damascus with family left behind, and also, you know, leaving, and that there was, you know, still these links and ties and things kind of almost pulling them back, whether emotionally or kind of actually back into that kind of Syrian sphere. So that was kind of one interesting thing. And then also just the kind of early wave nature of the story that, you know, obviously since the things depicted in your film happened, there have been many, many thousands of people passing through on similar or slightly different journeys. But just the fact that as you mentioned a number of times in the films, like a lot of these people were kind of pathbreakers almost, and they were doing things which hadn't happened before. Did these kind of things happen by choice, or was this just kind of how it worked out?
It's how it worked out. And to get to the first point of your question, it was really important to me that, and friends of mine, colleagues of mine suggested, you know, you made the trip with them, you were one of the first people, do something on just the trip. I didn't want to focus only on the trip, because the trip only explains, you know, half the story. Like I said, Aboud was not making this trip so he could get to Europe, and just showing him going through all these difficulties and getting to Europe is important. But like I said, it's half the story. I need to show why he was making this trip. And it was really important for me to be able to include, his wife and his two children who were still in Syria, talk to them about why they were leaving. And one of the most important parts of the film, of the series, is when the family has to leave Syria, because it's not, and it's something we too often neglect in the whole discussion around refugees. And you know, no one, especially from a country, an ancient country like Syria, an ancient city like Damascus, no one wants to leave. I mean, few people would, but the overwhelming majority wouldn't leave unless they had to. And that's definitely the case with Aboud and Christine, his wife. And you can see that in episode 5, how difficult it is for her to leave her family and everything she knows and everything she grew up with behind in Syria in order to start this new life in the Netherlands. So that was really crucial to me that, you know, after I did done the trip with Aboud to be able to tell this full, to be able to tell the complete story. The second part of the question, like I said, there was no, it was completely impossible from a production point of view to plan anything. So like, right. You know, luckily, like I worked for Al Jazeera, I had a staff job for many years, so I had a few bucks saved up in the bank. So I wasn't stressing so much about like a job. And I was just like, you know what, I'm going to take a couple months. I'm going to see where this goes. I had no funding, like I said, and you know, I can do everything more or less by myself. So I didn't have to worry about hiring a crew. And I just went to, first of all, I was filming with him in Turkey, then I filmed with him in Izmir. And then when he finally made it to Greece, I went to Greece a couple of times and just waited for his next move, not knowing what that would be, not knowing if he was even going to make it out of Greece. Because at that time, in April, May 2015, there were thousands, probably tens of thousands of Syrians and other refugees and economic migrants who had made it to Greece, but were stuck here and couldn't, you know, they were trying, as you see in episode 2, they were trying to fly with fake IDs to other European Union countries where they could seek asylum. But, you know, it was a 5% chance of success. Like most of them who were trying were getting sent back and they were, you know, living in pretty awful conditions here in Athens and other parts of Greece. So, yeah, when they started talking about this land route, I was like, you know, Aboud's like, do you want to come with us? I'm like, I've come with you this far. Sure, let's see where it goes. And they didn't know if they were going to make it. Just days before, people in the group and Hisham, one of the members of the group, talks about just days before he was arrested, before we made it successfully through Macedonia and Serbia. But just a few days before that, Hisham was arrested by Macedonian police and returned to Greece. So no one really knew what was going to happen, if we'd be arrested, if we'd be robbed, if they'd be thrown into prison in Macedonia or Serbia. And thankfully for everyone in the group, they made it through the Balkans and eventually to their final destinations in Northern Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminded me quite a bit of two things, I guess. Firstly, the I don't know if you are familiar with it, the Sean McAllister documentary, Syrian Love Story, which is, it's not about, it is about people living in Syria and the kind of social problems, but it kind of, takes different approaches to bringing these two sides of the story, both the current life in a different country, but also the factors that led up to the point where they're leaving and the problems relating to it. And it seems to me that you can't really tell that story unless you're able to give a decent amount of time to it, or at least it's difficult, even in print, like it's difficult to kind of build up all of these different layers if you don't have, you don't have the space or the time allocated to it.
Oh yeah, and this is the longest project I've ever done on my own, and it's amazing the kind of nuance, the detail, the intimacy that you can get when you are able to work in, you know, 20 minutes or an, I mean, my series is, I think, over an hour 10 or something. And yeah, you could just really get beneath the surface and really tell the story, I think, of who these people are. And I've seen Sean McAllister's film, Syrian Love Story, and it's, I mean, the access he gets and the way that he went to Syria before the conflict started is absolutely incredible, that he's able to tell this one family story over the period of however many years from before the civil war to during or after the revolution and the civil war. It's incredible. One thing I would say about Sean McAllister's film that really disappointed me, and I don't mean to criticize a colleague and a fellow filmmaker, because I think he's incredibly brave and I admire his dedication to the story, but this is a problem generally in coverage of the refugee issue, whether it be Syrians or Afghans. It's the inability to properly communicate with the people who are at this story. And we've seen it, and I've seen it when I've worked in news on this issue as well. News crews aren't bringing with them translators. And, right. You know, when you see Syrians arriving, yes, to Lesbos or Chios, they're like, oh, we have water in our country, we are leaving, blah, blah, blah. But that's really all they say. And, you know, Syrians have, mm-hmm, such a strong command of their language, of Arabic language. And when you can communicate with them, and my Arabic is imperfect, but at least I can have like a decent, you know, conversation with folks and ask questions that will get, you know, that will get at the heart of the matter. And being able to do that really makes a difference in how you can kind of portray and document these people's lives. And I was a little bit disappointed that Sean McAllister, having worked on this film for so long, didn't, I mean, he doesn't speak Arabic, and he didn't bring a translator with him. And I felt that was kind of an injustice to the people who were at the heart of his story, because they're left speaking in a language that's foreign to them, that they're not entirely comfortable with. It's obvious in the film. And I feel like they had a lot more to say had they only been able to communicate it in their own language.
I think that's such an important point that you just raised there. And I like your phrasing of, you know, getting at the heart of the matter. You mentioned, you know, the importance of being close to Syrians to be able to tell the story. Communication, like you were just saying, is obviously an important part of this. You know, it seems from just learning more about your work that this all builds on, you know, very extensive time in the region and your Arabic language abilities, which we'd actually like to discuss with you a little bit later in the show. Mm-hmm. You know, can you speak to the importance of sticking around, you know, in these areas that are usually only very briefly visited? Journalists drop in, or even experts, alleged experts, et cetera, drop in. But when you're living in a place and kind of imbibing everything going on, you can sink yourself into it. It becomes a daily experience rather than something so exotic, which can be almost a good thing. I've been here in Turkey for 3 years, actually working exclusively with Syrian refugees, and definitely, you know, strongly agree about the importance of getting the local perspective. And I appreciate your comments on, you know, it really would help if a few more people spoke even passable Arabic, and all that. But, you know, to what extent is this project, and even just your work in general, also just like a logical corollary for spending a lot of time in a place and soaking it up?
Yeah, so, I mean, firstly, could you imagine like a Russian correspondent or Al Jazeera Arabic correspondent going to the U.S. and being based in the U.S. for a number of years and not speaking English? Like, wouldn't that be so bizarre? But yet, that's the fact in the Middle East, is that overwhelming majority of foreign correspondents do not learn the language, do not speak Arabic. And I think that's really a massive problem with the general coverage of the region. And
why do you think that is?
I don't know. We get lazy. You know, we speak English. When you speak English, you get a little lazy because a lot of people speak English now. But in Beirut or Palestine or Syria, right. Yeah, there's the well-educated folks. They can speak English, and you can communicate with them. But the farmers or refugees or whoever, you know, who's really like been kind of in many cases been affected, most they don't speak that language. So it's important to learn it.
Or even if they do, the kinds of conversations that you have with them, you know, they're much richer if people can talk using kind of symbols and reaching back to things which they wouldn't have access to in English necessarily, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah, so for me, like, I've spent so much time in the region, and actually I'm quite sad by the fact that this is the first time in 12 years I'm calling somewhere outside the Middle East, if you include Turkey. I'm calling somewhere outside the Middle East home, because I do feel a very deep, you know, having spent so much time there, having met so many incredible people who have been through so much, I do feel like a very deep attachment to that place. And I'm pretty upset about having to have left, although Athens is still kind of the Middle East somehow. It feels similar in many ways. There's no mosque, there's no azan, you know, outside my window. But it's closed, so I can continue to go back whenever I need to. But yeah, I mean, it's such a complex part of the world. It's been the center of so many global problems over the past decade, if not more. And even though I've been here 12 years, even though I speak Arabic pretty well, I feel like I still have so much to learn about the people, the culture, and everything.
Right.
And I feel like I can report even more so than if they sent me to America right now to report on issues. I feel like I can report better on the Middle East because I have come to know a lot of the people in the region. And, you know, I know how to get past this certain, you know, like awkward introductions. I know how to say things to Syrians to make them feel a little bit comfortable, having worked with refugees and having spent time in Syria. So that's really helpful in reporting on this story. It's making people feel comfortable, explaining who you are, especially, you know, like people ask, why are you doing the story? I'm able to communicate to them, you know, why I want to make this film, why I want to report on their stories. And that helps a lot with gaining trust from the people you want to report on, which is very important. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talking a little bit about the importance of video and photography in telling these stories. Obviously, your documentary is not in words and using words. You know, to what extent is I think it was Marshall McLuhan said the medium is the message. You know, what is the importance of video and photography in telling these stories? In ways, what do they bring to the table in your view, that words simply can't pick up no matter how talented the writer?
Nothing against writers. I wish I was a better writer. And there's a quote on my website, and Lewis Wicks Hind was like a classic American photographer who documented, you know, like child labor and stuff 100 years ago, and was kind of an activist in the way that he was campaigning against child labor and for a 5-day work week and 8-hour work day and all of that. He said it best, like, if I could tell the story in words, I wouldn't need to lug around the camera, which I was right. thinking of when I'm on this trip. If I only just had a notepad and a pencil, I would have saved my back, saved my knees, because I'm walking with these guys in Macedonia and I have all this gear on my back. So that's a bit difficult. But for me, I'm a visual person. I'm not a writer. I wish I could write better, but I like to tell stories, people's stories through visuals. It's just another medium. I used to be much more of a still photographer, and I chose that medium because of its accessibility. You can put still photographs on a wall, on the internet, in email. You can put them, you know, in newspaper, all over the place. So they're very accessible, whereas 10 years ago, when I started doing this, video wasn't as accessible. You know, you had to watch it on TV, or you had to go to the cinema. So for me, it was kind of, elitist isn't the word, but like a special medium that was harder for people, ordinary people, to access. So that's why I like the still photography, because you could just, you know, blast it and share it however, wherever and however you wanted to. In recent years, though, as everyone knows, online video has become a lot more accessible, especially with evil companies like Facebook. but, you know, YouTube, you can just put stuff online, and people are watching video on the internet, and that's, I think, is great. And you can tell the story in ways in video in ways that you can't in text and in still photographs. So I've switched now more to the video side of things, because primarily because of its accessibility, because people can watch it easily online. And that's why I wanted to make sure that this film, didn't go to TV or didn't go in festivals or anything like that. I wanted it online so that, in theory, anyone and everyone who wants to watch it can do so. It's not blocked. It's on YouTube. So basically anyone in the world can go on YouTube and watch this video. And I'll speak about one more thing. There's very little money. If you want to be a journalist based in wherever these days, like if you're just a still photographer, it's impossible. I'm not doing any of this for the money, but I need to make a living. I need to support myself if I hope to keep doing it. And as a still photographer, you know, like when I was living in Beirut, I was taking pictures of cafes and new restaurants and that kind of stuff when they opened up. And that's, you know, that was just so I could make enough money to get by. And it wasn't fulfilling. It wasn't the kind of work that I wanted to do. So video work thankfully pays a little bit more, and that allows me to keep doing this kind of work and telling people's stories.
I'm going to assume that you've kind of been following the response. I mean, in kind of whatever form that takes, whether it's comments on the videos or just people writing about it. What has this response been like, and does it tell us or you anything about how some of these host countries are thinking about and feeling about Syrians and Afghans and others who flee their countries? Do you have any sense of that?
Yeah. First of all, the film was published by The New Yorker, but the film was commissioned by Field of Vision, which is a new documentary company founded by Laura Poitras, who made Citizen 4, the documentary on Edward Snowden, and also Charlotte Cook and AJ Schnack, who are filmmakers and people in the industry. So they commissioned the film. They're part of First Look Media, which is attached to The Intercept. And the plan is to publish the film not only in English, but we've also published in German with Der Spiegel. Right. And we're publishing soon with NRC, which is one of the most popular newspapers in the Netherlands. So for me, that's great in that we might publish in other languages as well. But for me, that's great that the film is getting out there, and especially people in these countries who have been so affected by the you know, quote unquote refugee crisis are able to see this story, because the feedback I'm getting has been surprisingly. I'm always prepared. I always have my shields up. I'm ready for like the attacks and all that stuff. But it hasn't come. And kind of unfortunate. I kind of like that when it comes, because I hope people are getting angry or you know, mixed up feelings about it. But actually, the feedback has all been pretty incredibly positive, and people are like, you know, wow, I've been following this story for the past year or years, and I've never thought about it in this way, and I've never felt as close to the people at the heart of it, and that's really important to me, because this is a story of over a million people who have gone to Europe in the past year, but it's a story of one family in particular, and I'm really, really glad, because when I met Aboud, I knew he had this story, I knew it needed to be told, and I'm really happy that people who watch the film are able to better understand people like Aboud, why they're doing this, what they go through in order to get asylum and to get to places like Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, and so on.
What does that reaction then tell you then? Because, I mean, there is opposition in Europe and America to people coming into their countries. I mean, that's not, I don't think that's not really something up for debate. So are these people just not watching your film or not commenting on it? Or are there two different conversations happening? I mean, because presumably you would like people who are opposed to it to also have a sense of the humanity of these people and whatever as well. So, I mean, what's going on there?
Right. Well, I don't know, to be honest, if they've watched the film, because they haven't sent me angry emails saying they have. I'm sure there have been some people who do feel that way, who are anti-refugee or anti-migrant or anti-foreigner, who have watched the film and probably don't have much to say, because a lot of their arguments get thrown out the window, which, like, you know, something you've heard a lot from anti-refugee movements in Europe, that these people are coming here for our resources, they're coming here, you know, to take advantage of the wealth we have in Europe, and they're coming here to force their views, their religion, their whatever on us. And like, all of those things are, you know, completely thrown out the window. Like I said, when you see Aboud in his story, he's not coming there for the wealth of Europe. He's coming there because it's his only choice to be with his family. And, you know, when he says in episode 6, and it's a line that I love, and it's just so, like, typical Aboud. He's just this nice, open-minded guy. He's like, you know, people are saying that we're going to change them. Like, if you look at his street, and he's in this small town in the middle of Netherlands, he's living in a predominantly, like, 99.8%, let's say, you know, like, white Dutch area. Do you really think that he's going to, like, you know, force his views? Of course not. Of course not. And this is also a policy I like of the Europeans right now, where instead of placing people in urban centers only, they've really spread people around the country, which is difficult for refugees. And if I was a migrant or a refugee, I wouldn't want to live in rural Netherlands for the first year or two necessarily. But it's good in that it's, I think, helping the integration process, not only for the refugees to understand the culture and the countries they're coming to, but also for people in these areas who, a lot of them, you know, especially in the rural areas, support the right wing, are a bit xenophobic, maybe racist. And they're meeting now people like Aboud and changing their views because they're able to, you know, now they have neighbors who are from Syria or Afghanistan, and they meet them and get to interact with them. And I think that's a good thing.
What is, or what was the most difficult moment in filming this or editing this or putting this together? Was there kind of one thing that was a persistent challenge for you or a difficult moment, you know, in the actual filming of it? What was the hardest thing for you on this project?
Filming with the family was definitely the hardest, and I really wanted to go to Syria to film with them, but I didn't because it would have been hard to get a visa. And not only that, but I didn't want to bring attention to the family by, like, you know, getting a visa and then the government knowing that I would be filming with this family. So that was difficult, and that was something I struggled with. But thankfully, I found through friends of friends, I found Simone Safia, who's a very young director and video journalist, video producer, who's in Damascus, who was able to kind of film with Christine and the kids kind of under the radar without bringing too much attention to them or their family. So I'm happy that worked out. And it wasn't, you know, in the end, it wasn't that difficult, but it was hard at the first, you know, couple months in finding someone. Other than that, you know, definitely the trip was difficult. And I've said this before in other interviews, is that, I wish that I could have done it properly. I wish I could have had a crew. I wish I could have been walking with them and set up my tripod and done, like, you know, beauty shots or more shots more beautiful than I did. But, like, you know, it was really difficult walking through Macedonia and Serbia and even on bikes trying to film while riding bicycles and worrying about, you know, my own health and well-being, because it was pretty fucking tough trip. But also worrying about things like, you know, logistics, like battery, media. I didn't have a computer. It wasn't easy to stop and recharge in places. So we went for many days without being able to recharge batteries or anything like that. So that was a constant concern when making the trip. And also just being worried about, you know, getting arrested, being detained by police, which almost happened once, if not twice. And the whole story would have been ruined, at least from the filmmaker's perspective. So that was all kind of like concerns that I was constantly, I mean, my biggest concern was the well-being of everyone in the group, especially when the kids and the elderly and the pregnant women and all those kinds of people entered the group. That was my main concern. But then secondly, I was concerned about the gear and, you know, being able to preserve and make sure the footage would be safe and I could get it to a computer later and do something with it.
Just to switch gears a bit, although kind of taking a similar kind of themes that we were talking about, you were involved in kind of co-editing a book, which is kind of testimony, kind of voices, I'm not quite sure how to describe it, from the Middle East and North Africa relating to the Arab Spring. And I'm fully on board, as Matt is, you know, on the need for people to kind of come into contact with that kind of material, with authentic, original voices, ideally told in their own language, not kind of mediated through someone else. But obviously, as maybe you found, like, there is a difficulty in terms of how exactly to get that across, how to make it consumable, how to get people over that kind of doorstep into spending time with those voices. So I'm interested if you had any thoughts on your experience of particularly with regards to that book you worked on how to get people interested, and whether you think even there is any value or point beyond the kind of purely documentary value to those kind of projects.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, like, for those of us who had covered the, you know, quote unquote Arab Spring and the Arab uprisings, it was important that, you know, myself and my co-editors in the book, that we give space to the people who are from these places and who experience things in a much different way than, you know, those of us who are covering, who are not from those places and we're covering the stories. It was important that we gave them space to be able to tell their own stories. And it was difficult. And I haven't spoken about the book in a long time, but it was difficult to, firstly, you know, find the people, especially when they're in the middle of these situations. Like Ali Adderi, our writer from Bahrain, he was actually exiled and became a refugee because he couldn't go back to Bahrain because of the uprising and because he was in opposition. So to find people who, I know you have a lot going on in the country right now. I know there's literally maybe bombs falling on you, but do you think you can write a 5,000 word essay, personal essay about your situation? You know, and so it was difficult to get them on board and get them to, you know, find people who had the time and the energy and the ability to do this kinds of stories. But I'm happy we were able to find a lot of people who could talk very personally about, you know, what's happening in their countries and what's happening to them. in the midst of this, like, you know, massive global news story, the Arab uprisings of 2011.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about this earlier about, you know, it's a nice theme in this conversation is the you know, telling stories through kind of intermediaries, but, you know, you learning Arabic and being able to understand the stories essentially without translators for the most part. You know, what in your view, just with a broad eye to the state of journalism, could be done to improve, assuming this is a valuable service, I guess, what could be done to improve, you know, things on that front? Should everybody just be required to learn languages? That doesn't seem practical. Is there anything that you've come into as you know, this is something that could really push the ball forward to help more accurately understand the world, which is all any of this work is always about?
Oh man, it's such a big question. Firstly,
I apologize.
let's destroy all the journalism schools. No, I'm joking. But like, I have friends who went to Columbia Journalism School, and they're great, and they're absolutely incredible reporters, and they've learned a lot. Unfortunately, like, a lot of us who are reporting on these regions are from similar backgrounds, and a lot of us are middle class white guys and white women from, you know, the West who come and report on this stuff. And I think that lack of diversity is a problem, in that we all kind of like come from these different backgrounds and end up covering things similarly. I'd like to see a lot more diversity in journalism. I know I'm
so
part of
that
the problem.
That idea of groupthink, of following the herd, which I'm sure you know you've seen as well.
Yeah, and it happens
more
in Istanbul.
Would get, exactly. Yeah,
and if you go to Istanbul and Beirut, you see all the foreign correspondents hanging out together. They're very close, and I'm friends with a lot of them as well. And I think that becomes a problem because, like you said, the groupthink mentality, and like, you know, everyone becomes friends and they think alike and they talk about the issues in the same way, and you know, they end up reporting. There ends up being a lack of diversity in the kind of coverage. Ultimately, though, I think what it takes is long form, which I hope is not on the way out. I know we're seeing. I used to work for AJ Plus, and they're doing these like 90-second videos, which are informative and great, and going viral and being shared on Facebook and Twitter and so on. I think those are great, but if we really want to get beneath the surface, like I was saying earlier. You know, you can't do that in 90 seconds. And it's an injustice to people who are, you know, literally dying in war in Syria or dying on the way to reach Europe. We need to have the space available to properly tell their stories, to properly portray these people's lives and show what they're going through. So I know there's been a lot of discussion. Is long form on the way out, or is it here to stay? I hope it's here to stay, because with these 90-second videos or with short write-ups in the newspaper, we need feature content that can get beneath the surface and really tell people's stories.
You've kind of worn different hats, as you know, would be clear to anyone listening up to this point. You know, you had the kind of activist kind of background maybe at the beginning, and now you're.
Oh yeah, I was definitely hardcore activist for sure.
You have this kind of journalism side now. I'm wondering how you kind of see your role. Is it more kind of archivist and documentarian for the kind of historical record for the kind of long term, or do you have a stronger sense of wanting a more immediate impact, or is it a mix? Or
definitely I want the immediate impact, because I mean, the historical record, I love history, and I've been so influenced by, you know, books and documents and films on things that have happened over history. I think those are equally important. So I hope these projects live on in 20 years from now, or whatever. People are referring back to projects that I've worked on and using them as a resource. But of course, I care about the immediate impact. I mean, Aboud is, you know, in covering his story, and especially what he talks about the end of episode 6, you know, like the problem is not these refugees who are coming to Europe. The problem is that they still have conflict in their country. The problem is people are still dying. And this is at the core of the refugee crisis and what we need to address if we want to solve it. And yes, I have no problem admitting the fact that, you know, I'm not a robot. I care about these people. I care about people being affected by war and conflict. And I hope that the war and conflict ends and persecution ends so that these people can live normal lives like any of us do. So yes, I do hope that any project I'm involved with, because it's usually talking about stories that are happening now in the present, I hope that they will, you know, maybe it's a bit naive to say, but change the way people think about it and lead to, you know, people taking action to do something that can prevent more people like Aboud. Even though it's a happy story, gets to the Netherlands, he can be with his family. He didn't want to do this. He didn't want to have to go through this. So I hope it can prevent people from having to take these dangerous trips. I hope it can lead to a discussion of how can we, you know, stop conflict and war and in the Middle East and beyond. I definitely want it to have an impact now. That's very important.
Getting into your methods, looking at your toolkit, it would seem that a camera is extremely important, but also your Arabic language ability, I'm going to assume, has been an indispensable part of, you know, of your work and given you a lot of leads and insights into the depth of your work. I guess we really have two questions here. One, what was your approach to studying Arabic? We've actually had quite a few guests on the show who all have, made their struggle with the language. If it was formal education, did you go through kind of like Fusha, like all these other, you mentioned in the start of the show, the 9/11 generation, I can certainly relate to this. We all studied Fusha for years and all that stuff. Did you go that approach? And then if you did, second question is, what about colloquial Arabic? What are your tips or essentially your thoughts about building into actual conversational Arabic with people who call the Middle East home rather than just, great, you can read, formal text.
Yeah. Yeah. Young people out there, do not study Fusha. So it's a waste of time. No, it's not at all a waste of time. Because you can read books, you can read the newspaper, you can watch, Al Jazeera Arabic, you can watch the news and understand it. It's definitely not a waste of time. However, I know a lot of people, and you guys can probably relate to it, who have spent literally years studying Fusha and can communicate in Fusha, okay, but that doesn't really help them when they go to places like Syria where, you know, the Syrians can understand Fusha, and it will lead to some funny conversations and people laugh at you for speaking Fusha. But it's not the most helpful in communicating with ordinary people in these kinds of places. So I never formally studied Arabic. When I went to the West Bank and I lived in Balata refugee camp outside Nablus, I spent a lot of time there, and people there, most of them, maybe it's different now, but 10 years ago or 12 years ago when I was there, they didn't speak a lot of English. So I was by myself as a foreigner and just kind of spending time with these folks and listening to them, listening to the language, and just making an effort, making notes and words that I heard, asking, oh, marhaba, okay, writing that down, what does that mean, And the most important thing when I think learning a language and wanting to speak a language is you have to be prepared to make a fool of yourself.
Right.
So like I just said, marhaba.
Yes.
I don't know, I was like dyslexic with marhaba, and I used to say all the time for like my first 6 months, I could never remember if it was marhaba or marbaha. So I would like walk in, and marbaha means nothing, but I would walk into shops or meet people and be like, marbaha, and they would just laugh at me. But Palestinians, like Syrians, Lebanese less so, but really, really make an effort when they see a foreigner speaking, trying to communicate in their language. They're really great in that they take pride in that someone, is coming from abroad and trying to learn their language, and they really make an effort to help you. So that's basically how I learned Arabic, is just spending time with folks and not being afraid to make a fool of myself. In Lebanon, it's a lot harder. We could talk about, don't go to Beirut to study Arabic. I mean,
absolutely
Lebanese,
not. Yeah.
Not only because of like, Lebanese are very, well-educated, and most of them are bilingual, if not trilingual. And so when you try to speak with them, they'll want to practice their English or their French or whatever, so they'll communicate with you in that way. But Lebanese officials are also, I thought like by going and like getting my paperwork done when I was living in Lebanon, speaking Arabic with police who didn't speak English necessarily would help that process. But I would always go in and speak Arabic, and then I found myself in like the middle of a 3-hour interrogation, like asking why I speak Arabic.
Right.
So, yeah. That was kind of funny. So I made an effort not to speak Arabic in Lebanon, actually. But yeah.
I'm interested just in terms of your kind of future or at least the kind of just general coverage that you see as someone who's been involved in the Middle East for a long time and the coverage of it. What stories or trends or voices do you think are extremely important at the moment that aren't really receiving much coverage?
You guys know what's happening in the region. There's so much going on and so many stories that need to be told. Where to begin? I mean, the problem, though, as journalists, as filmmakers, is just the access now, because even 10 years ago, journalists had, I think, a lot more freedom and ability to travel around, to go to these places, to report from them than they do now.
Right.
And unfortunately, as you've seen with a lot of our colleagues in Syria who have lost their lives trying to cover that conflict and other conflicts in Libya and Yemen and so on, it's a really scary time, both for foreign journalists and local journalists, but local journalists especially, because they don't always have the privilege of a foreign passport to travel and leave with if they have to. So it's really difficult to access that we as storytellers and journalists can get these days, and I think that's unfortunate. So as for future projects, I mean, that's kind of, and that's why I did I want to go to Syria. I've wanted to go to Syria for a long time and do something long term on what the situation there, but I haven't had that access, and that's why I focused a lot on the refugees over the past couple of years, because it's a story I can't get access to. But there's really, I mean, just pick any conflict. There's people at the heart of that story with stories who need to be told, and unfortunately, that conflict is happening from, speaking about the Middle East or the Arab world, all the way from North Africa to Yemen and beyond. So anywhere. I would like to tell these people's stories. And I'm thinking about a few projects next. I would like to do something long-term on Gaza. I'm hoping to be able to do that over the next year. I just finished the film a couple weeks ago. So right now I'm just trying to think about, I haven't started really any other projects, but I'm thinking about where to focus next.
Mindful of your time, we're just kind of getting into the last bit of the show. Like, is there anything particular book that you'd like or to kind of push our audience towards in this direction?
For people interested in the Middle East, I guess.
Oh, whatever.
Well, I think like required reading for anyone coming to the Middle East should be Amin Maalouf, Crusades through Arab Eyes, because a lot of us who are interested in the region, we know about the Crusades, and this just kind of like, spins it 180 degrees and tells a story, as the title says, through the eyes of the people who were not the Crusaders. It's a really important book. Kapuscinski is probably my favorite writer, even though there's accusations that he always wasn't, always telling the truth. But I think he's still a great storyteller, even if he does bend the truth a little bit. And I think there's a lot to learn from his technique and his, the way he came at the stories is just remarkable. And the way he traveled around as a poor Polish journalist from Soviet Union during the mid 20th century. For Istanbul, 1453 is a book whose author I can't remember now, but that's a great account of the Ottoman conquest of Istanbul and the loss of the Byzantine Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire. And in Lebanon, Beware of Small States, Lebanon Battleground for the Middle East, is a book by David Hurst, who was a longtime Guardian correspondent. I think he was based in Lebanon for something like 50 years.
Yep.
He's also written The Gun and the Olive Branch, but these are my two favorite books. The Gun and the Olive Branch is more on Israel-Palestine, and the Lebanon book is obviously more on Lebanon. But these are two of the most important books, I think, on what's happening in Palestine and Lebanon.
Matt, did you have a pick for the week?
Yes, I recently finished a book by Sarah Bakewell called How to Live, or A Life of Montaigne in One Question and 20 Attempts at an Answer. It was fantastic, particularly if anybody's never read up or since their formal education on the life of Montaigne. It was particularly interesting in how his one collection of essays essentially has had such a different life over the centuries, from being, a church-approved text to an anarchist text to a, just a book full of contradictions, et cetera, et cetera. It's a great, great book.
Matthew, did you have a chance to think of a film?
I've just I've seen so many films lately, but Laine, the French movie by Matthew Kassovitz, Laine, the Hatred. I saw this movie when I was, you know, much younger, and I just saw it again.
And it's fantastic.
I love this movie. It's so good, and it's like so creative and so different, and tells the story of these guys and, you know, the Parisian suburbs, and it's such a beautiful movie. So yeah, I highly recommend, if you haven't seen that movie, or even if you have seen it, to watch it again, because it's incredible.
Matt, sorry, Alex, what's your pick here?
I'd just like to pick up on the theme that we've been talking about, Arabic and learning Arabic. Nothing new to regular listeners of this podcast for sure, but I'd just like to mention publishers called Lingualism, and which are relatively new on the scene. They have, as we were talking about earlier, it's kind of difficult to get into the language which everyday people actually speak, either in terms of comprehending it or starting to use that yourselves. And these publishers, Lingualism, are really doing a kind of great service with some of the things they've been putting out. Most of their focus is Egyptian Arabic, which doesn't really help you if you're focused on Syria or Iraq or that kind of area. But they have, there's a series of books called Arabic Voices, which are really well put together at a kind of great level. If you've got a year or maybe 2 years of Arabic, formal Arabic study behind you, it's a way to start getting access to these colloquial voices. And they're really friendly for people who are studying Arabic, self-study on your own, as opposed to in a kind of classroom environment. So I really recommend you check out the stuff that they have. It's really valuable and useful. Matthew, do you think of a song or some kind of musical element?
Totally off topic. I actually got to see Move to Athens, and PJ Harvey I've loved for a couple decades now. So I actually got to see her in concert 2 nights ago, and she has a new album out, and it's more political than her previous albums. So PJ Harvey's always someone I really love and respect as an artist. Don't really have any song in particular. She has had so many great ones over the years, but if I had to pick a musician, she'd be the one I'd recommend these days.
Very good. And as a final question, how can people, listeners to the show, et cetera, stay in touch with your work, keep up with what you're doing, et cetera? Where can we find you online?
You can Google Matthew Castle. And I have a website. I have Twitter, Facebook. Even though I'm thinking about like deactivating my Twitter and Facebook accounts, I keep saying that, but I don't think I really will.
Yes, do it.
I'm so fed up with social media, you know, and I know a lot of us are. But yeah, you know, I'm on the internet. Everyone's connected these days, so you could see it that way. You can watch The Journey. Just, Google The Journey from Syria, or Google The Journey and my name, and it'll come up. It's on YouTube. A lot of people are having trouble with the New Yorker's video player, especially if they're outside the U.S. without a great internet connection. So you can watch it all on YouTube. It seems to be working a lot better for people. And I'm trying to focus more on the long-term stuff, so I probably won't have another project or film coming out right away. But, you know, a few months from now at least, if not more, hopefully something else will be out there for folks.
Great. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been a real pleasure to discuss these issues with you.
Yeah, thank you guys. Really appreciate it.
For our listeners, if you heard a reference to something, a book or a website or an article, the full show notes with everything to what we discussed in the show can be found at sourcesandmethods.com. If you enjoyed what you heard this week or in previous episodes, please consider writing a review of the show in iTunes or on Twitter or maybe even in real life. Thanks for listening.